If you are surrounded by a lot of concrete where you live, you know that on a hot summer day, you can really feel that heat radiating off the buildings and the sidewalks. But thanks to research going on at UW-Madison, we're learning a lot more about the effects of living in an urban heat island. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to be talking about that research and how it can be used for more effective urban planning with our two guests, Chris Kucharik, an associate professor of agronomy and environmental studies. He's with the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison as well. And Chris, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Larry. Always a good time to be back.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jason Schatz is with us too, and he is a graduate student in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, affiliated with the Water Sustainability and Climate Project. And Jason, thank you for coming by as well. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much, Larry. I'm excited to be here.
Chris, when we talk about climate, let's talk about climate for just a little bit. When we talk about climate, what are the elements that are taken into account?
So it's usually the long-term temperature, precipitation patterns over long time periods. I mean, if we had to define a time period that's used, it's usually a 30-year record. So if you're listening to the weather on TV or the radio and they're talking about the normals or the averages, or that's the number that they're using. And those mm-hmm. generally are updated then every 10 years by organizations around the world.
And those are for the most part, natural things. What about human factors relating to climate?
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, all of the temperature data that's been collected, there's some discrepancies about, some of that's, been taken in urban areas, some's been taken in natural areas, but climate on the long term really is something that we generally would expect to feel on average. And it gets harder when you start thinking about the very micro scale effects that can take mm-hmm. place, that can affect our everyday lives.
It's pretty interesting that Jason, you and Chris just published a study in the Journal of Applied Meteorology and Climatology looking specifically at the climate differences between Madison, Wisconsin, and surrounding areas. That's, I thought, really interesting research. Talk about how you gathered that data for that first.
Sure. So, our main research question was just how does the urban climate behave and what are its impacts? So to study that in 2012, in I think March, we installed 150 temperature and humidity sensors across Madison and Dane County. So we have a large set in the city itself, quite a few around the lakes to get a sense of what impact they're having, and then a bunch at varying distances, like out into rural Dane County, so we can compare the city to the rural areas. And the sensors are mounted on streetlight and utility poles that we're using in cooperation with Madison Gas and Electric, Alliant Energy, the City of Madison, and a bunch of other community partners. And they record data every 15 minutes and just give us a really detailed picture of the climate across space and across time in the Madison area. And so far we've recorded 2.5 years of data.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Now, somebody might say, Chris, why in the heck are you studying this? I mean, I know it's hotter when mm-hmm. I'm in downtown wherever. Sure. Why do we need to know?
Yeah, I guess, to start off, we haven't discovered a new phenomenon. This is something that's been known, for many, many decades, over 100 years, probably. But it's the detail with which you need to understand how the numbers play out. It's not a one-size-fits-all. That magnitude of temperature difference isn't the same in July as it is in December. So, it's really enriching our knowledge and trying to understand, are there certain times a year that, we can do things that might have an impact, other times a year where it might not have such an impact. And all these, are related to, human health, how much energy we use, trying to predict, how things might change if you superimpose on top of that the larger global climate change signal that we're all going to have to deal with simultaneously.
Yeah, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. I haven't even given the number yet, so let me do that. Do you live in a city setting, or do you notice that heat difference? Any questions about climate as we visit with our two guests today? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on our program's Facebook page. Facebook page is called The Larry Mueller Show, so if you want to go there, please do, or you can join the page, too. Click like while you're there, and that would be wonderful as well. So, again, the call-in number, though, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. So here we've got a city, which we, what would you call that, a medium, Madison, a medium size, probably?
Sure.
Yeah. City. What do we got, 500,000, something
yeah,
like
in
that?
Yeah, in the overall metro area, it's around 400,000 or
about
so.
About 400,000?
So, yeah.
And a downtown that's like a lot of downtowns, there's not a lot of trees and there's a whole lot of pavement. And so what do we got for differences? What were some of the findings?
Yeah, so specific to Madison, we found that the heat island effect peaks during the summer. And during the summertime, Madison averages about 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer during the day and more like 6 to 10 at night. And, you know, again, those are averages, so that's a typical day and night. Sometimes are a little less, and sometimes we observe differences that were quite a bit higher. So, you know, like Chris said earlier, we weren't surprised to find a heat island effect here, but the size of it over just a few miles was pretty amazing.
That is amazing. And to me, now I'm just thinking about it, knowing Madison as well as I do, we've got essentially two lakes downtown, or one right in the downtown, Lake Monona. So you'd think that would be a mitigating factor, right. Chris.
Yeah, well, let's squash that myth right now.
Yeah.
The Madison, Lake Mendota and Monona are not big enough to have a large effect on temperature patterns. It just doesn't work out that way. I've run into people when they learned about what we were doing. They're like, oh, the lakes keep the downtown area cooler, and this isn't Lake Michigan. Jason's got some stats, I think, on just how much bigger Lake Michigan is, you know, compared to Lake Mendota. We can all see that. But you really need a much larger water body that will have another kind of local effect on the climate, like you see in the cities of Milwaukee and Chicago.
Is humidity would be affected then too, I assume.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. Like temperature effects during a hot summer day, like right on the lakeshore, it might be a little bit cooler. But yeah, like Chris said, Lake Michigan's surface area wise is over 1,000 times larger than Mendota. So, I mean, Mendota's a big lake, but it's not quite big enough to have those kinds of temperature mm-hmm. effects. So once you get away from the lakeshore, it doesn't matter that much. And then in terms of humidity, it actually has a little bit of a larger impact because, like you're probably imagining, it's a big open pool of water out yeah. there to just be constantly evaporated. So as you get near the lakeshore, you get a small temperature effect, but a much larger humidity effect.
I think about our weather forecasts that are always out of Milwaukee and or for that air region, and it's always, well, and cooler near Lake Michigan
right.
is always a comment that comes up, and there you have it. Greg in Madison has a comment. Greg, hi, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Larry. I think this research is just great, and I think Kane County is the perfect place to do it because we have so much natural areas, but also the big Madison Center, but it's all reachable by the university. So I don't care if there's any immediate applicability or not. I'm really curious about this type of thing. So, like, I want to know what the temperature's like south of the Terminal Moraine compared to Madison, because it seems like it gets pretty wild. Well, we have such varying geography. So, again, I think Dane County is a perfect place to do this. I think it's basic research. I think some people have tried to use the urban heat island effect to deny climate change, and this could help fill in the gap in our knowledge, and maybe it'll even help make better weather predictions.
Yeah. Comment, Chris? Comment. Thank you for calling, Greg.
Yeah, thanks, Greg, for calling. So, yeah, south of the Terminal Moraine, I mean, once you get far enough away from the zone of influence, you know, I think the temperature patterns generally fall into what we would generally expect or be able to predict. But, you know, small changes in elevation can definitely create their own little microclimates. And you could take a transect of temperature sensors along, you know, that area and begin to find out those things. In terms of, you know, weather forecasting, the only thing I will say is that, you know, oftentimes you'll hear of either TV stations or maybe other companies selling out the ability to do a microcast or micro forecast at like the city block level. And to this point, they're all wrong. I mean, unless they start considering our research. And I'll shut up there.
Oh, great comments. Thank you so much again for that call. And let's take another call. Chris in Madison, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry, and hi to your guests. About a year ago, I was working on some pilot research looking at lake surface temperatures using Landsat thermal data. And one thing I noticed while I was making those measurements was that farm fields and agricultural fields appeared warmer on the Landsat imagery than the surrounding areas with natural vegetation. And I was wondering if you guessed to talk about how much influence agricultural fields may have on climates as, you know, compared to cities and natural land cover. Thanks.
Chris, let's turn to you for that. Good question again. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Chris, for calling in. So I think it depends a little bit on what time of year, you know, when you're using the satellite imagery to look at the field. So if you think about ag fields, they're really, a lot of them in our region are bare from, you know, maybe October, November after harvest, you know, through about mid to late April when planting starts. But then it's even, you know, maybe another month before you get green up of that vegetation. So you'll, those satellite sensors will see, you know, a lot of the bare ground and basically that darker soil will warm up and be, you know, warmer than the surrounding regions for the natural vegetation that always exists. So that would be one example.
Yeah. And I think we've noticed, or I've had on other programs that this has come up as a discussion. If you, in summertime, Iowa, for example, with the millions of corn acres of corn, it definitely has an impact on humidity as well, isn't it, Chris?
Yeah, that's right. There's times you can look at dew point maps, you know, over the U.S., and there'll be this bullseye of elevated dew point temperatures over Iowa, and you know immediately that's all the corn and soybeans that's being grown across that landscape.
Oh, man.
Yeah, yeah, and this actually dovetails really neatly with one of the general findings of our studies, which was just looking at how the heat island varies across the year. So, you know, heat island urban climatology studies have been reporting this for decades, that the heat island's usually strongest in the summer and weaker during the rest of the year, but no one's really explained why. There are a lot of hypotheses out there, but no one's had the data yet to test between them. But with our network, we were actually able to do that, and we found that those seasonal variations are really closely linked with vegetation. You can actually, if you chart out heat island intensity throughout the year, you can see it ramping up in spring, like coinciding with spring greening, then peaking throughout the summer, and then once fall gets here and the leaves start turning and the crops start being harvesting, it falls off really, really quickly. So
yeah, and all the leaves fall off the trees, and yeah. And then snow has, and in the wintertime, has a, in a way, a kind of a leveling effect, does it not, or am I wrong?
Actually, it's interestingly, it's sort of the opposite. So if you think about like the lack of vegetation has a leveling effect, but snow itself actually enhances the heat island a little bit, because the heat island effect is really due to the difference between rural and urban land covers. So the more different they are in terms of their cover, the more different they are in terms of their climate. So if you think about snow cover, in rural areas, it's just a uniform blanket of white snow for the most part. But in the city, we have building walls exposed.
Oh,
we have
sure.
a lot of roads being plowed and melting occurring more quickly. So they just, during the winter, they appear a little more differently with snow than they would with just bare ground. So
very interesting.
Here, the snow has just a little bit of an enhancing effect.
Really cool stuff. We're talking about urban heat islands today with our two guests. Chris Kacharik, Associate Professor of Agronomy and Environmental Studies at UW-Madison, and Jason Schatz, who's a grad student in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, affiliated with the Water Sustainability and Climate Project. You can join in with your questions. We're going to get to Jim and Karen coming up in just a few seconds, but there's a line open for you at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on my Facebook page. Go our Facebook page is The Larry Mehler Show, and we certainly hope you will post there as well. I'm Larry Mehler. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're learning about some really interesting research on urban heat islands with Chris Kacharik and Jason Schatz of the University of Wisconsin. Great to have them along, and thank you again for calling in. Go to our Facebook page. It's called The Larry Mehler Show if you'd like to join in with a question, or phone us at 1-800-642-1234. Jim and Madison up next. Jim, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, hello. Thank you for taking my call. About a question for your guests. What would happen to the urban heat island effect if we painted all the city roofs white in all the cities? Would that have an albedo impact? Would that be significant? So on and so forth. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. Jason, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a great question. And he's exactly right. Painting the roofs white would increase the albedo, which is just how reflective the surface is, and it would reduce the amount of sunlight that was absorbed. Although it would be effective, and it is effective in cities where it's being implemented, but it's still an open question in Madison how much of a practical impact the heat island is having on our daily lives and what we might do about it in terms of management and mitigation. Like if we were in Phoenix, Arizona, for example, like any extra heat from the heat island would be unwelcome. It's not helping anyone because it's already brutally hot there. But if we were in, say, Fairbanks, Alaska, then the extra warming might not be so bad. But here in Madison, we're sort of in the middle, so it's a little more of a mixed bag. Certainly we can reduce it, but the degree to which it'll be profitable to do so, I think, is still an open question.
I've thought, often marveled at the great job that Chicago's done, or I think that they've done, with their rooftops, grass and trees and so forth. That has had an impact, has it not? You think?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, those are all really effective actions, and Chicago's done a great job with white roofs and green roofs and increasing green space, and they've done it like specifically to mitigate the heat island. I think especially with the heat wave they had in the 90s, they were concerned about mitigating that. And here in Madison, I mean, we do have a lot of green space. We have a lot of street trees. We have a lot of parks. So, you know, without those, I think it's important to keep in mind. Yeah, it would be a lot warmer. So we're already doing a pretty good job. But yeah, certainly it's always possible to do more.
Karen in Jefferson, your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hello. I am interested if any research has been done on heat islands of smaller cities, for example, 10,000 inhabitants, right? I live between two cities that have 8 to 10,000 inhabitants, and my phrenology through the past, I've been keeping track of when my perennials and trees will be blooming, and tulips and peonies and that sort of thing. And I find that so unreliable in the last 5 years. And I don't know if this is mini climate change or what, but I am out in the country, and I find that I take a walk in the towns that have 10,000 inhabitants. The homes are closer together, making things warmer, as well as the sidewalks and so forth. And I find that when I walk around there, I am doing better than in other words, there things will bloom first. So I know to look for my peonies are going to be next. Or I see a certain type of tulip that they have that I have. And some years my early, mid, and late tulips have all bloomed at the same time. And so I find that that's more reliable, you know, to take a walk around there because it's it's warmer there.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. You're a very observant person, Karen. Comment from you, Chris?
Yeah. So, Karen, yeah, you're to answer, I think the bigger question you're asking is that, yes, there, you know, smaller cities can have a definite heat island effect. The zone of influence, you know, how far out that effect extends really is a product of, you know, the size of the city and the population and how much maybe industry, you know, is going on in that town. But surely you're noticing, you know, what we refer to as microclimates, you know, small things that can change, you know, due to changes within the infrastructure of a city or, you know, what's generally, you know, on the landscape. So it's a great observation. And yes, you're noticing, you know, what we would expect.
Very good. Thank you very much for calling. Got a Facebook question from Peggy who's wondering how much the impact of the many tall apartment complexes currently under construction downtown, I think she's talking about Madison, will have on the heat impact. Will the temperatures go up during the day and night? What about wind impact?
Yeah, that's a that's a good question there. I mean, I don't think that, you know, any, you know, a few extra buildings here and there are going to change, make much of a difference. I think, you know, we already have created that footprint, you know, over the last 150 years of development.
Yeah.
And the main thing we're concerned about is the expansion of that, you know, the connections between the sister cities around, you know, the Sun Prairies, the Veronas, the mm-hmm. Fitchburgs, when Middletons. That starts to mm-hmm. to fill in more, and that ag land that you still see in between the city outskirts and, let's say, Verona becomes filled in, you know, you're just going to have to go further and further away to get out of that zone of influence.
Yeah, well, yeah, and as I was just thinking about it, the Odana Golf Course in Madison, for example, used to be way out of town.
Right.
And
yeah, it's interesting. Just in the 2.5 years we've had the sensors up, we had a bunch of sensors just at the edge of the city, like just a little bit out into agricultural areas, and now 3 or 4 of them are being filled in with housing developments. So we'll be able to see those things firsthand. But yeah, I think Chris is right. Like, fundamentally, it won't. A few extra buildings won't impact things, but yeah, it is expanding really quickly.
By the way, so you're planning to keep this going as long as you can, or what do you? What's the goal?
Yeah, the goal is, I mean, I think we can get a base understanding based on the data what we already have, you know, in the time period. You know, you get a few years. We did have an extreme year, 2012. Everyone remembers it was a really hot summer, 39 days above 90. But it's, you know, about now if we do a longer time period, and we're talking like a decade or 15 or 20 years, what Jason had just alluded to, we can start to see the effect of that urban expansion, just how important, you know, that is, or detrimental, let's say, to the local climate.
Yeah, I kind of hope you can keep it going. I don't know in terms of the expense or cost of keeping those units up there in telephone poles or whatever. But
yeah, you need good people. Jason's got to defend his PhD sooner or later. I have talked, you know, we've talked with Madison Gas and Electric previously about, you know, I guess my pipe dream would be to turn those sensors into real-time sensors where we don't have to climb up on a ladder and collect the data. People could go online and actually see that data happening as, you know, in real time, basically.
And frankly, then anybody could, too.
Exactly.
You could have others as well, which would be wonderful, too. Bob in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, guys.
Morning.
I was an undergraduate at UW-Green Bay from 72 to 75, and at that time, Green Bay had the moniker of Environmental U, and unfortunately, I cannot remember the names of the two instructors that taught environmental science, but they did some groundbreaking work on heat islands. And we had in January, and Green Bay is cheek by jowl with the Green Bay of Lake Michigan, which, of course, at that time was frozen. And we did a pretty extensive study mapping out placement of thermometers and measuring snow and measuring moisture and all kinds of things. And we did this in January of, I think it would have been like 74. And I know they continued that because eventually they published a new textbook. I had that textbook. Unfortunately, we lost it in a house fire, so I've lost everything on that. But the thing of it is that even in January, in Green Bay, the land of the frozen tundra, we were able to demonstrate a measurable heat island in downtown Green Bay as compared to the outlying area. It was dramatic. It was several degrees
difference. You know, I want to break in and let comments come from Chris and Jason. Chris, do you want to start or do you have a comment?
Sure, yeah. I mean, not surprising at all. And I think there's, you know, Jason can follow up on this. You know, just the number of studies that have, you know, occurred in the last several decades has been pretty big in terms of urban heat island effects. I don't remember the names of those faculty either. That was a little bit before my time, but I wonder if Jason has run across anything.
I don't remember them specifically, but you know, it's always interesting to think about it in places like Green Bay or places. I mean, there's actually a really good study that was done in Barrow, Alaska. I mean, up in the Arctic Circle on the North Shore, and they had an urban heat island effect there. It's just a small, you know, Arctic town, barely even a city, and they had a heat island effect there. So yeah, it's pervasive for sure.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. One of my former doctoral students was in charge for the Department of Natural Resources of the North Slope of Alaska and lived in Barrow, Alaska for many years. And the North Slope of Alaska is bigger than the state of Wisconsin. It's a pretty good size area there. And a pretty small community. Barrow is very, very small. Brian in Menasha, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I've been listening to you guys' conversation, and one thing I noticed, perhaps it's just something I've seen over the years, but I'm curious, because I'm from Kenosha originally, the heat island effect, like the Milwaukee-Chicago corridor, I'm wondering if the heat island effect has, or I should rephrase this, with the exception of like very large storm fronts, does the heat island effect have an effect on precipitation, like diverting, or does it push around, or like namely in the winter, does it turn a snow event into a rain event due to the heat island effect?
Yeah. So, Brian, yeah, it's a really great question. I know that there is at least one study, is it Atlanta, Jason? Yeah, that has shown an effect of their heat island on increasing precipitation. You know, in our region, particularly Madison, Green Bay, Eau Claire, there's probably not going to be an effect. At least I wouldn't expect there to be. As you get closer to Lake Michigan, you know, Milwaukee, Kenosha, Racine, Chicago, they're actually dealing with the proximity of Lake Michigan. Oftentimes people say that sometimes flow off the cooler waters of the lake will actually diminish the intensity of storms there. So that might counteract if there was any particular impact. And then just one other small observation is actually, you know, like on snowfall during the wintertime, and I know this from driving, when I drive into work, I'm coming from northeast of town into the city, that if you have a really light snowfall at certain times of the year, Madison, it will melt quicker. Like, yeah. And I always thought, oh, it must have snowed more out near Sun Prairie where I'm at versus there. No, it's not that at all. It's actually the warmth of the city is actually causing small-scale effects on those types of snow dynamics.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I live on the opposite side near Verona, and sometimes I'll come into campus, you know, before dawn, before it has a chance to warm up and melt, and there's snow in my yard, but as you get into town, it's gone.
It's gone. It's gone. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Brian, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Laurel in Sturgeon Bay a chance to join us. Laurel, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Hi, thanks, Larry. I am calling because I have been involved with a group that just built a 10,000-square-foot concrete skate park in Sturgeon Bay, and some of the kids would like to look into the possibility of planting trees to offset the heat index of the park, and I was wondering if you could give me an idea of how we would do an equation or someone we could talk with, or if there are any other models that you know of like that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Jason?
Yeah, it's a great idea and a great question. I don't have any specific equations for that. I would just say that, generally speaking, the more trees you have, the more you'll offset it. But, yeah, like a big concrete plane will have a warming effect, but any trees or green space that you can put in there will counteract that quite a bit and just look nice.
Yeah, I think the one question we struggle with in terms of development here in the city is, you know, would we have a greater effect at mitigating the warming if we had one 1,000-acre park versus 1,000 1-acre parks that are scattered all around?
Yeah.
And, you know, I would argue that probably the 1,000-acre park might have, you know, more of an impact. But, you know, we don't have any way of really testing that right now. So to Laurel, I'll just say, you know, plant as many trees as you can possibly afford, right? That might be one way to approach it. But, it's great to hear that they're thinking of doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important point. Like, people have to live somewhere. People have to put skate parks somewhere. There are better and worse ways of doing that. Putting one in and planting trees is probably one of the better ways.
In my own little microclimate, we had a 200-year-old tree on the east side of the house, kind of the east and south side of the house, and that tree had to come down. And we went from having no air conditioning or need for air conditioning to really warm.
Right.
Conditions because of that one, losing that one tree, which was a real sad thing to happen. So there you go, Laurel. Plant a lot of trees.
Right. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, what a difference that made. We have questions from Mike on Facebook. Does the urban heat island effect include a similar decrease in dew points? And are there additional increases in temperatures in the city areas next to the Beltline highways?
So the effect on dew point is not, there's no, we can't really say there's any strong effect there.
No, not really big, no.
Yeah. And then I guess saying he's when he's coming in and approaching the Beltline, well, that might be slightly confused with where the sort of impact of the highest intensity part of the heat island might be occurring, and that the Beltline happens to sort of maybe dissect some of the more densely populated areas from those that aren't. But surely, as you get closer to the Beltline on any given day with the traffic and heat of vehicles and pavement, you're going to have an even microclimate effect there within the larger heat island effect of the city.
Mike wondered in an email, he says, in a greenhouse, it is easy to calculate the solar gain per square foot of glass. Is there a simple formula for calculating heat gain caused per ton of CO2 released in the environment?
Right. Yeah, I think this is getting at the what we refer to as global warming potential, where we put any of the associated greenhouse gases, whether it's nitrous oxide, methane, you know, or CO2, on a level playing field, and we can calculate just how much of a radiative forcing that gas has on the climate system.
We have Eric in Madison with a question. Thank you for calling, Eric. Appreciate it.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about, and I know we're focused on Madison and Wisconsin right now, but wondering if your guests have a perspective or have seen any research on whether some of the multiple global climate models have incorporated heat islands into their sort of into the climate forcing that's incorporated into those models.
Yeah, Eric, that's a great question. That's a tough one. Knowing the scale at which global climate models run at, or global circulation models, as they're called in our field of science, they run at such a coarse resolution compared to that that only the really, really large urban expanses would probably factor in. So you're not going to see like the city of Madison, you know, showing up, you know, as part of that. So that's probably where we're at, unfortunately.
And, yeah, and I think scale is an important consideration there, because if you think about the global, like, cities have a strong impact on the temperature of the air inside them, but in terms of their whole effect over the entire global land surface, like, it's probably relatively small.
What about municipalities? We've kind of gotten at this, I think, a little bit, but what can municipalities do to help offset effects? Jason, you want to?
Sure. I mean, again, I think it's an open question as to what types of, still an open question about what types of management and mitigation make sense for Madison. But we do know reliable solutions, like increasing the amount of green space, increasing how reflective our roofs and our pavement is, and those are really the main simple retrofits that you can do, and they're effective. It's just really a question of how much of it makes sense for your city.
Yeah, and then even getting smaller to the individual level, what can we do, or what could I do in my house, or anybody else do in their home or in their property to make it better?
Right. Well, I think your story about the 200-year-old tree that came down is perfect example. Like, trees are so valuable. The type of tree, where they're placed, provide windbreaks, protection from sunlight, can really reduce your energy usage, and I don't think that's going to be a surprise to the listeners out there.
No, I don't think so either. And boy, this has been really interesting, guys. I thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having us, Larry.
Thanks very much, Larry. It was fun.
And we'll keep track of these guys and see what as more data become available as to their research on urban heat island effects. Our guest, Chris Kacharik, who is an associate professor of agronomy and environmental studies, and Jason Schatz, who is a grad student in the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And we'll talk with them again. I hope we do. That was fascinating for me. Coming up next, we're going to cover some similar topics, I think, relating to weather with one of our weather guys, Steve Ackerman. He's going to give us an update on the hole in the ozone. And we're going to talk with him a bit about climate change and the research relating to it. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.